I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Last week, we heard arguments against tax increment financing. Critics of the tax breaks argue the tactic draws money away from schools and other public projects. But TIF supporters say the measures are an invaluable way to redevelop blighted neighborhoods. Today, we'll take a look at the benefits of tax abatement and their role in shaping Kansas City. Then, how do you know when it's time for a new hip? And what are the early warning signs that you might need one down the line someday? We'll hear from medical experts about modern joint replacement surgery, when it's necessary, and what to expect from the healing process. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Mention the acronym TIF in Kansas City and the blood pressure of some citizens skyrockets. TIF is often criticized as a tax abatement for developers that comes at a cost to other taxing districts, such as the library and the school district. But supporters call it an essential tool to spur development. Today, we'll focus on why TIF backers regard it as so essential. Last week, we devoted a segment to TIF opponents, so today is the flip side. Under a TIF program, the city redirects the increased tax is paid on improved property back to the developer. In parts of town where the return on investment is shaky, TIF reduces risk. With us to talk about TIF, Kathleen Flournoy is with the Economic Development Corporation of Kansas City. Kathleen, good morning.
Good morning.
Cindy Circo is the chairwoman of the city's TIF Commission and a former mayor pro tem on the Kansas City City Council. Cindy, nice to have you again.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, this is the pro side of this debate. Why is TIF such a vital tool for development of Kansas City, Kathleen?
TIF is allowed for redevelopment in areas that would otherwise not occur, specifically the downtown revitalization, infrastructure being built north of the river, and now we're seeing momentum move east of Troost as a result of the Heart of the City TIF. So it's been vital in the revitalization of Kansas City.
But it's supposed to be for blight, Cindy Circo. So where does that enter into all this?
Well, it is blight, we have the debate between the north and the south TIFs, and you've got very different districts. You've got old buildings that are historic. There's so much more to redevelop them, and there's a bigger risk to redevelop them. And then you have the infrastructure needs on the north side of the river. And so it's a tool. It's a tool to address that. And it is, you have to fundamentally believe, but for TIF, that these projects would not be invested in. So it's a combination between the TIF and market investment.
But as you know, there are some listeners out there right now who are thinking to themselves, well, we've had TIF on the Country Club Plaza. That's not blight. That's not but for. So what about situations like that?
Well, that's a conservation TIF, and so there are different types of TIFs, and that is an area that the dynamics of shopping changed very dramatically, and the plaza is iconic, but isn't the user-friendly that people were expecting in today's world, and so there was a conservation for an area of a project that, but for some changes, these projects would start declining over a period of time, and it is deemed from city that this is an area we want to make sure doesn't decline. So a conservation district is a different finding than blight.
So there's a place for TIF, you're saying, even in locations like the Country Club Plaza.
It's in locations that is deemed that with the historical significance of it, that having it decline would be a detriment to the city.
Kathleen, I'm wondering if we didn't have it, if we didn't have TIF in this town, what would be lost?
I would say downtown Kansas City. So the Power and Light District is a result of the construction of the H&R Block building, which is a TIF area.
And that was pretty blight. I think everyone would
Absolutely.
Agree that was pretty rough. Yeah, back in the
Absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely. The expansion north of the river would be lost. That is an economic development designation TIF, which allows for the construction of infrastructure. So you would not have the growth that you have north of the river now as a result of TIF.
So bottom line, Kathleen, is it essential?
Absolutely, it's essential if it's used properly and if it's used in a manner that Kansas City does, in a responsible manner.
And using it responsibly is what Cindy Serco's commission is all about, right?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, we're using third-party analysts to show that there is a need to utilize TIF. And when that need is not shown, it's not used.
You know, I'm wondering if the two of you can just talk about some of the best-known projects that have benefited from TIF. You've already mentioned a couple here, but just so people can wrap their arms around sort of what this tool is and what it's done for our community. Cindy, what would you point to?
Well, an easy one to point to, because the 23-year clock has ran out. So TIF is in its first generation in Kansas City. Those projects that were started in the early years, 23 years or so, are now starting to come off the books, so we can evaluate them. But the Shoal Creek TIF, that was an infrastructure TIF. And but for that infrastructure being put out there, you have 550 new homes.
And where is Shoal Creek? Just remind people.
That one's north of the river.
That's the big housing development up there.
The big housing. So that was a public infrastructure one. So the assessed value on that prior was $3.7 million, and now at the end of the TIF, it's $35.2 million, the assessed value. So you've got to, we're taking very seriously at looking at our TIFs that have gone through their full cycle and learning from them. And there were some bad development agreements that the city went into. We don't do those things anymore. We've looked at them. We've created policy around them. We've improved them by virtue of going through the experience itself. And we look hard at these TIFs. A lot of times they never come to the commission. Our staff at the EDC will evaluate a developer's request and say, no, this one just doesn't fit. So we don't ever see those. So the premise that we approve everything that comes before us, it is vetted before it comes before us.
But the idea now is that some of these projects you say are coming off the TIF designation, so they should be, in theory, be able to spin out additional tax revenue to the city that the city would never have seen if it hadn't been for the TIF.
Correct. So you take, let's say a project starts on day one, and the revenue that coming off of that piece of property that has a building that's getting ready to fall down, maybe a dollar. So a developer comes in and feels like this is something that if I had a little of assistance, I could really turn this around. So they take the increment increase throughout that year. 25% of that stays in the other taxing jurisdiction's coffers. So as that raises, that dollar raises, 25% of that raise stays with the taxing jurisdictions. So they're getting a bump along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end...
So again, the idea here is that as a project begins, is developed, and the tax property taxes go up on that project, the developer keeps that as a way to develop the project.
So 75% of that.
75% of it. So... that's additional money to the developer to build the project. But once the lifespan of the TIF, once it expires, that additional tax revenue that the project develops goes to the city and the school district.
100% then of that now increased taxes actually go to all the taxing jurisdictions, correct?
What project, Kathleen, would you point to, or a couple projects that people might identify with that became a result of a TIF designation?
I think the Midtown TIF is been highly successful. That's the Costco and Home Depot at 39th
yes.
Street in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And dollars that not only were used to redevelop the area, but then also fund a successful housing program. So you were able to eliminate blight. You were able to eliminate the hazards on the street corner where people couldn't even walk to and from. It's a much changed area.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to piggyback on what Cindy said. So real property tax is one component of tax increment financing. Personal property tax goes directly back to the city and the other taxing districts. That does not play into the TIF redirection. So they may only receive 25% of the real property taxes, but they're receiving 100% of the bump through personal property taxes.
What other projects would you guys point to, Cindy?
New ones are the Aldi at 39th and Prospect,
mm-hmm.
A much-needed grocery store in the 3rd District. Linwood Shopping Center, another much-needed revitalization with another grocery store on east of Truce, that both were grocery stores were the number one conversation while I was on the council trying to create lessen the food desert. So those are social issues that we can address with the TIF also.
I want to get our listeners involved here. To what extent is TIF, do you see TIF as a viable economic development tool for our city, or has it been abused too often and does it need to go away? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to a call here. Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Kevin, good morning.
Hi, good morning. This is a great idea of having the pros and cons, two separate shows. Thank
right.
you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. On this, TIFs, you know, clearly can serve a great purpose. Downtown is a magnificent example and so forth. But claiming that TIFs for the plaza, the country club plaza, is just so weak and to the point of silly, it ends up just being welfare for the already wealthy, first of all, and it weakens the schools, and it takes away from what needs to happen, yes, on the east side of Tristan, on the east side of the city. It's indefensible.
Okay.
Just for the plaza.
Yeah, Kevin, I appreciate it. And, you know, Cindy Serco took a shot at that a few minutes ago, defending it. Kathleen, do you want to add anything to, because it's that one that has caused a lot of Kansas Cityans, has given them pause when it comes to TIF and how important it can be.
Well, I think just looking at the nature of retail and how it's changing right now, looking back to how it was prior to the construction of that parking garage that it, what the TIF is funding, that parking garage assisted us in bringing in Lockton to Kansas City. So it's a bigger issue than just TIFing the plaza.
And also that is a big company on the what on the northwest side of the plaza,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I recall trying to park on the plaza prior to the construction of that particular garage. And I know there are other garages, but it made a difference. I think that, you know, again, just looking at the nature of retail now, we need to try to stay up with the times, hopefully, and keep the plaza a viable resource for shopping.
Let's go back to some calls here. Kip from Kansas City, Missouri, who's a TIF supporter. Kip, good morning.
Yeah, I'll try to keep this brief. I'm right in the middle of all of this, and I'm a private developer, a smaller one. I don't use TIF, but they're putting some significant TIF in around me. And people who are against TIF, talking about the loss of revenue to schools and the city and all that, don't realize that this land is not generating anything now and hasn't for five decades, but they don't offer anything in return. The next thing, it was a criticism of TIF. If they're going to use TIF, they need to have a requirement they use local contractors, because we could really have made this a huge economic boon if they would have hired locally. We've tried to get in with these people, and we can't. So, anyway, I'm pro-TIF,
yeah.
So keep it up.
Kip, I appreciate that call. Cindy Serco, you used to serve on the city council. You're on the TIF commission now. What about Kip's idea of making a requirement that local contractors, local developers be used in conjunction with these TIF projects?
Well, local was always one of my issues, that there always seemed to be a roadblock through the legal aspect of that. Is if we're going to use our own incentives, then why are we not only using local developers? But I mean, you can go even to the airport conversation where it didn't go that way either. Mm-hmm. So there's a competition factor and a legal factor that keeps us from saying only local companies can do this type of work.
Yeah.
I do think that we encourage locals to always be applying, but in the end, it's the developer's decision on who they pick. And as long as they're meeting our goals that are set, and we do put minority goals on each one of these projects, and those are monitored throughout.
Mm-hmm. You're saying, I'm going to make one point clear here, that one of your points is that TIF is monitored and administered much more closely today than it was. You mentioned some projects coming off the rolls, you know, 20, 25 years ago. Is that right?
I would say it is correct. When I came in as chair, I was asked to go in and find out where the issues were and what we needed to address. And I think that we kind of had a perception of what it was, and I ended up with a very different view of what we needed to do. And I said, we need to take a deep dive, look at our history, look at our policies, let's start adjusting those. We have in place a great team. We have a good committee that take each job very seriously.
And the mayor is very much backing this process.
Absolutely. Compliance is a huge issue. We make sure that the revenue being reported is being reported, and that we are doing proper closeouts for each one of these projects. and that if there's amendments, we have great understanding of what that amendment to that project means. So it's a very engaged committee. I don't want to say other committees in the past haven't been, but I think the political will is also there, and that we had some lessons learned. And so I feel like you have a very strong, thoughtful commission, and that the staff serving that commission is feel like they have a voice in this matter, too.
We're talking this morning about the importance of tax increment financing in Kansas City. It's called TIF, very controversial, with our two guests here, Kathleen Flournoy with the Economic Development Corporation of Kansas City and Cindy Serco, who is chairwoman of the city's TIF commission. Our phone number, again, 816-235-2888. You know, critics, again, have really pounced on this notion of the word blight, and they continue to say that too many projects that are approved don't really meet the qualification of what most people regard as blight. In fact, there was a push this session in the Missouri General Assembly to rein in TIF one more time. The bill hasn't gotten very far, but its sponsor, Blue Springs Republican Representative Dan Stacey, said TIF has been abused. In fact, he said this, Kathleen, the biggest concern is as the most connected or many connected developers pursue this type of scheme without much evaluation of whether it's for the intended purpose of a TIF, which is to help particular blighted areas. Again, this is a concern you guys deal with a lot.
It is. And again, there's three different statutory designations. Blight is one. There's a conservation area, which would be an area that has buildings 35 years or older. And then again, there's the economic development statutory designation. So there's three different types of areas that TIF is meant to work with.
And maybe lawmakers don't understand that.
They don't. And I was one of the people in Jefferson City working on these bills, trying to educate lawmakers on so that they do understand how Kansas City utilizes TIF.
You know, Patrick Tuohy with the conservative Show Me Institute has been highly critical of TIF. He wrote in the Star last year that TIF is overwhelmingly used in already wealthy and economically vibrant and predominantly white parts of town. Kansas City has used TIF to subsidize the world headquarters buildings of successful corporations such as H&R Block, J.E. Dunn, Burns & Mack, and Cerner. Taxpayers have subsidized luxury high-rise apartments and will soon be asked to pitch in on a convention hotel. This is written before the hotel was approved for visitors from out of town. We've even helped fund an entertainment district downtown only to have it accused of enforcing a dress code that discriminated against African Americans. That summarizes so much of the opposition. Cindy, what about that?
Well, I would beg you to go talk to the neighborhoods in South Kansas City on how they feel about Cerner's headquarters being landed there. It has been the catalyst of what was needed for the Southland to start turning around. And that community has wrapped their arms around that TIF and wholeheartedly supported it. And there's funds that come from that TIF with going to Hickman Mills School to help with the workforce development that would directly affect Cerner's workforce. So there's a lot of good that's happening with TIF. I'll never dispute that there's been some mishaps along the way, and that's reality. But to say that it is a tool that needs to be thrown out completely, I think, is false. And Kansas City would be a very different city if we didn't have it.
Kathleen, does TIF have a public relations problem, and does it need to change?
Absolutely. It's a difficult concept to understand.
Yeah, sure it is. And people tune out pretty quickly.
They do, because it is tough to conceptualize what the redirection of taxes means.
And here I am doing a radio show on it.
Exactly.
So what do I know? Yeah, yeah. So
it's an education process that I personally have been working with the lawmakers in the area trying to educate.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. And Barbara from Kansas City, Missouri. Barbara, nice to have you. Good morning.
Oh, thank you. I am wondering if TIF can somehow be used to support affordable and low-income housing. I've lived here 40-something years, and now I will be out of a place to live in a very short time, and I cannot find anything, not only in Midtown, but anywhere so far, that I can afford to live in. And I know multiple people in that situation who are just saying they're probably going to be on the street.
How about the connection, Cindy, between affordable housing and the use of TIF?
Well, TIFs have supported some affordable housing projects, so that's not unusual to a TIF project. I think the affordable housing project, like many cities that are growing, is a policy issue at the council level that that conversation is being spurred right now. TIF is not a tool that is a sole tool that creates that, and there's also many TIF projects that assist that. So I think it's a tool that can be used to help assist, but isn't the creator or the fixer of affordable housing. That's a policy direction.
Okay. Barbara, I hope that helped a little bit. Let's go to Kim here from Overland Park. Kim, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, I'm calling to ask about how the economic development works, because we have a very controversial TIF one here in Overland Park with Brookridge redevelopment taking a golf course in a floodplain, and the developer wants to put in $1 billion site, but yet says he needs TIF to be able to afford the different phases of this project, and nobody in the neighborhood wants this project. So I guess and we have lots of economics here, and we also have a lot of mixed use sitting empty. So I guess I'm confused as to why that area is considered life or economic development or the case. So I guess I need some more education.
Cindy?
Well, I really can't help particularly to Overland Park, because each city has their own policy direction on how they use TIF. The tool itself is regulated and by the statute at the state. So there are those levels of guidelines that we all follow, but each city has their own policy direction on when they would use that tool. And I do not know Overland Park's policy on it.
Okay. Kim, I hope that helped.
Sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You bet. Let's go to Emerson from Kansas City, Missouri. Emerson, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about tax increment financing, the hot, sexy topic of the week here in Kansas City. Good morning.
Morning. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about how I feel that it kind of de-incentivizes local communities already that are putting in a great effort to, especially areas like the Crossroads in downtown, where there's this natural growth of artists that are wanting to make community. And when TIFs and other projects come in, it's actually trying to push some of these people out of the way, too. So I think it's kind of de-incentivizing what artists and what the community is already doing.
Kathleen?
I would say speak to that. Gentrification in the Crossroads has always been an issue. And unfortunately, the artists coming in and revamping and revitalizing the area does push out those that were able to create the area. I know the city has worked with the Crossroads area to try to keep some affordable space for artists through a planned industrial expansion authority tax abatement that was renewed last year. So that is one program that the city has focused on the Crossroads specifically in order to keep gentrification at a lower level. It's a chicken and egg, because you do want the revitalization, you do want the redevelopment, and unfortunately that does sometimes push out those, which is why, again, the policy discussion of affordable housing needs to come into play as well.
It's difficult, because you do begin redeveloping the east side, everyone clamors for that, then you do it, and then gentrification comes, and then people begin to scream, so it is tricky. Cindy?
Well, I think TIF has become like the tool that everyone can talk about. It's three little letters that no one really understands, but they want it to either stop harming something or they want it to fix something. And it is just one single tool. I think the reason it has become such a public thing, and I would agree, we've done a bad PR job on explaining a very difficult tool, but it is the most public process for any incentive that is available to developers. And so you hear about it all the time, because it is in the public arena where other incentives really aren't so much. And we have to remind ourselves that it is a single tool that needs to be used in collaboration with everything else that's going on. And we do want to develop, but how do you develop? And these are the growing pains that cities have. This growing pain is a positive pain. It's making us have conversations that we need to have as a city, and it shouldn't stop there.
I just want to end with this, that concerns about TIF were great enough in 2016 that the council actually reformed TIF, if you want to use that verb, and capped TIF funding at 75%. It used to be 100%, right? Meaning that you can't get – what does that mean? Maybe you can explain it better than I can.
So that is the, correct me if I'm wrong, but that is the where the 2575 come for the taxing jurisdictions that I talked about earlier. And, you know, it's part of the learning process. You know, we're, like I said, we're in the first generation of it, and we felt like, okay, we have moved along in Kansas City, so now it's time to start tailoring this a little bit more, and you'll probably see more reforms going forward, or even policy directions, as we feel like we've used the tool where we needed to, and we're moving on to another space, or we're lowering the incentive, or we may do the incentive in a larger path for one part of the city and not the other.
But basically, developers can't get 100% tax break. It's a 75% tax break on their property taxes. At the time of these reforms, Mayor Sly James said this: if we get this wrong, we could once again put up a sign that says Kansas City is closed for business. We don't want development to come to a screeching halt. Has that happened as a result of that ordinance, Kathleen?
Absolutely not. I think that we, I think it's caused us to be more thoughtful,
right,
moving forward. You know, again, from what Cindy has said, there's a lot of vetting that goes along with an approval process. We do contract with third-party analysts to have us show us the need, financial analysts and planners to show us, you know, is this an appropriate use of the tool?
Right.
And the 75% has just caused us to make sure that we're using it properly.
We're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Kathleen Flournoy. You just heard her voice with the Economic Development Corporation of Kansas City. Cindy Serco, chairwoman of the city's TIF Commission. Thank you both for an enlightening conversation.
Thank you,
Steve. Appreciate it very much. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about hip replacements and joint replacements and knees and all kinds of stuff. And boy, can I talk about that. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we talked about classic rock and posed the question, is it coming to an end? You can listen to that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow on the show, a few days before people gather to celebrate one of Kansas City's most talked about streets, we'll hear perspectives on the past, present, and anticipated legacy of the Truce Corridor. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. So your knees ache and it's not going away, and you're wondering, is it time to get a new one? Or maybe it's your shoulder or your hip. That was my situation. Years of basketball and football took a toll, and in the last year, I've gotten not one, but two new hips. And yes, let me tell you, the pain is gone. Now a conversation about when it's time to get that new knee or hip or shoulder and what's involved in getting what doctors call an implant. With us are two guests from the Kansas City Orthopedic Institute. They are Dr. Christopher Peer, as an orthopedic surgeon specializing in the treatment of knee and shoulder conditions. Dr. Peer, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Steve.
Hannah Rousen is a physical therapist and a doctor of physical therapy. Hannah, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Well, what might one, why might one need a knee or hip replaced, doctor? Because for me, it was because of a single word, and that was pain. How do you know?
Yeah, right. So pain is really the principal indication for joint replacement surgery. And it really comes down to you have to have pain. You have to have pain over a prolonged period of time that interferes with your activities.
This is not something that comes and goes. It's with you all the time.
Right. And it has to be a result of arthritis. So you have to have the correct problem, so to speak, with the knee or the hip in order to solve it with an artificial joint.
And you say arthritis, you mean that it's bone on bone. There's not much cartilage there to sort of buffer those things from rubbing against each other.
Yeah, right. So a little bit of a common misperception is that in most cases, the diagnosis of arthritis actually just means a loss of the joint surface cartilage. And so the cartilage is what normally keeps the bones from rubbing against one another when you lose that cartilage. Our common term for that is osteoarthritis.
So when you do a hip or a knee, you know, what gets removed in these procedures? What do you do?
So the part of the bone that is involved in the joint is removed. We use a saw.
Yes, you do. It's like carpentry, I'm told.
Yes,
quite
a bit.
That's what my doctor told me about.
Right. Yeah. And so the end of the bone where it forms the articulation or forms the joint with the next bone, that's the part of the joint that normally moves. We remove those both of those surfaces in almost all cases and put a new surface on it, so to speak.
You know, Hannah, when I got my first new hip, one of the aides at the hospital was getting me ready, and he said, "Hey, did you watch the procedure on YouTube of what this is all about?" And I said, "No, I didn't." He goes, "Do not do that, because that would be a bad thing to do, because this is pretty invasive. This is, again, carpentry at work here, right?"
Yes, for sure. Yeah, it definitely is.
How rough is it? I mean, how would you describe it?
Well, that's probably more Dr. Peer's in the surgeon room, so he would probably be better at that. But it's very aggressive. A lot of, you know, there's a lot of pain afterwards too, and people have to take time and have patience to get over that post-surgery pain too, because it is a rough, invasive surgery.
How much time are you looking at for rehabilitation from a knee or a hip or a shoulder, for that matter? Those are the most common ones, I think.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, that's the most common one. I would say, and everybody's a little bit different, just regards to how they get their motion back and how the therapy's going. But I would say probably for a knee replacement, anywhere between, you know, 8 to 12 weeks after surgery, people are kind of in therapy, or at least formal care. And then afterwards, you know, it doesn't mean that you're done with your exercises totally when you're done coming to see us, but probably on average 8 to 12 weeks. And then a hip replacement's usually a little bit less, maybe 6 to 8 weeks or so, just as long as we're getting their function back and everything's going, you know, according to plan. Usually it doesn't take as long for the hips. And then shoulders are usually just longer than that. More range of motion to get back. Sometimes they start later in therapy than a hip or a knee replacement would.
What's the toughest one to recover from, based on your experience?
Oh, gosh. Probably whoever had whatever one done would say that it's the hardest one to come back from.
But I had hips, and everyone told me that, hey, knees are a lot tougher.
Yes.
And that was my experience. I mean, it was not a walk in the park.
Right.
But it was not the worst thing I've been through in my life.
Yeah, I would say probably knees are tough for people. I think, you know, that you're using your legs a lot. Granted, you're using your shoulder a lot too, but I'd say between knees and shoulders are the toughest ones to get back to.
Which one gets replaced the most often, Dr. Peer?
Right now, it's the knee.
The knee. Why is that?
I think there's sort of an aging baby boomer component to that. The indications and the age of the patient. So the indications meaning, you know, we used to say, well, you have to wait until you're after 65 before you get a joint replacement. And that's just not true. So we're replacing knees that are arthritic in younger and younger patients. And they're more successful. They last longer. So we're more willing to do that in a young patient.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that the population has become more active and they accumulate more, you know, injuries over time that sort of add up and contribute to loss of the joint surface cartilage eventually.
As someone who does this for a living, would you tell someone who wants to avoid something like this, quit running, quit jogging, quit, you know, how do you avoid it, or can you avoid it?
Yeah, so in rare occasions, people will choose to, you know, dramatically curtail their lifestyle. My background is such that I want to enable people to continue an active lifestyle. So it's uncommon for me to really say to someone, you know, you just need to go sit on the couch and your knee won't hurt as much.
Right.
You know, we try to make intelligent decisions based on the severity of the disease and how demanding the, you know, the person's lifestyle is, and figure out what's going to work for them.
But Hannah, once you get a new knee or a hip, as we're talking about those parts of the body, yeah, I've been told, you know, my jogging days are pretty much over. And is that the case?
You know, I think for the longevity of the prosthetic itself, any of that impact activity can wear down that sooner than if you weren't doing any jogging or impact activities. I think a lot of that's also physician dependent, what they feel comfortable with their patients going back to doing too. But that's not to say I still have, you know, patients that have had replacements that get back to impact activities or really want to ski or something. I don't really necessarily recommend it, but I know that people do get back to doing it. It's just going to be what restrictions their doctor gives them to.
Dr. Peer, how do you feel about that? You know, people with a new hip or a new knee going out and skiing or jogging again or whatever.
Yeah, so that's definitely an area that's controversial. I used to practice in a ski town, so I expected all of my knee replacement patients to go back to skiing. But the American Association of Hip and Knee Surgeons does have a list of activities that they sort of recommend against. That being said, many of us continue to let our patients do more and more as they continue to be comfortable. And I do let patients jog. I have a patient with a knee replacement who's a college basketball coach. Occasionally we see him on TV, and I cringe a little bit, but he's out there running around with 20-year-olds playing basketball for all intents.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I would find that tough, I guess, after two hips, but maybe I'm just a big baby. I don't know. Yeah.
You know, and I don't do hip replacements. I do knee and shoulder replacements, but I think that different surgeons will feel differently about it. And some patients, they really seem to fly, they sail. You know, clearly not all knee replacement patients could perform that level of activity comfortably.
Yeah. Hip replacements, knee replacements, shoulder replacements. That's what we're talking about this morning on Up to Date. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Do women or men tend to get the most replacements?
It's women.
That's going to surprise people. Why?
It's a good question, and yeah. if we really knew the answer to that, we might be doing less knee replacements. But I think, you know, there's probably some genetic components to it. There's probably some morphologic components to it. There's research that suggests that there's certain risk factors, but I think that it still remains a bit of a question mark.
You know, you do these things more often for women. Is there a correlation between how active you were as a younger person and the need for knees and hips?
Yeah, so there's some great
shoulders. Yeah.
There's some great correlation data on that, particularly with regards to, say, for example, marathon runners. And so it turns out that in America, if you're a marathon runner, you're more likely to have a joint replacement at a younger age. But for the contrary to that is if you live in Australia and you're a marathon runner, you're less likely to have a knee replacement at a younger age.
Help me with that.
Yeah, so very controversial paper and a lot of discussion among surgeons and rheumatologists about that. The best explanation I heard was that the culture of running in Australia promotes the idea that if your knee hurts, take some time off. And in America, the mantra is run through it. No pain, no gain.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's the way we look at it. But sometimes you run across people who weren't active, they weren't athletic, and yet they still have to get a new knee or a new hip.
Yeah, and that's just poor cartilage, and that's likely genetic.
So that happens.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. 816-235-2888. We're talking about hip and knee replacements, implants, the medical community calls them. Let's go to some calls. Bill from Shawnee, good morning.
Oh, good morning. I had to have both of mine done before I was 65.
Knees you're talking about.
My knees, I'm sorry, yes. Part of it was genetics, part of it was just I wore them out, but I sing the praises of my orthopedic surgeons. The one thing I know with the gentlemen that I play with in golf and everything, a lot of them are shying away from it, but I think part of it is because they don't go to the gym. I think they're more fearful of the recovery and the pain than the actual surgery, and it's just my opinion, but I don't think anybody wants to give up their original body parts, but these that I bought are working well.
How was the recovery for you, Bill?
Well, for me personally, it went rather easily. I did continue to go to the gym trying to work through my knees, so my legs were in pretty good shape when I went into it. And then I also contribute to the fact that I don't have as many brain cells, so I didn't know how hard or how much it was going to hurt.
Yeah.
But the pain part was fairly easy. The biggest fear I had, obviously, was the opioids, and I kept them to a minimum.
Okay. Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You know, one thing that surprised me, Hannah, was I didn't find the process painful at all. That's not the word. It ached a little bit, but even that was really manageable, and I might have taken one or two pills the first couple days. And that was it. I mean, I didn't find it to be like this excruciating thing, right, which is what I expected going into the whole thing.
Yeah, I think a lot of times people, they complain more about stiffness. And, you know, after a prolonged period of time, I sat for 5 minutes and I got up and I have to let my, you know, knees or hips warm up a little bit before I move them again.
I find that to be true.
Yeah, and that can last for a while for people. Mm-hmm. I think they're always, a lot of people are surprised at how stiff you can be after you sit down for just 5 or 10 minutes. But I think stiffness and aching and discomfort are the primary complaints rather than sharp stabbing type pain.
But I did hips again, but knees can be different though, right? Here that's, you know, trying to get it to bend, that can be a little more painful. Am I in truth and advertising here?
No, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find that, yeah, usually knee replacements, they are battling more pain just because you're working through motion more. It doesn't just kind of come as naturally with the bending and the straightening. And when you're walking and sitting, your knees are bending. And so I just, yeah, knees are more painful for
You know, what also surprised me was on the same day as the surgery, the nurse came and got me a couple of hours later and said, mm-hmm. okay, Mr. Kraske, we're going to go for a walk now. And your body and your brain, you're thinking, no,
this is not happening.
Right. This is an unnatural thing you're asking me to do. Right. But sure enough, you get up and you walk and it's really not that bad. And I remember, you know, we did a couple laps around the nurse's station and I sort of, I wanted the nurses to look up and applaud me. I was thinking I was doing something remarkable, which of course to them was routine
expected,
nothing out of the ordinary at all. But you just do this thing and away you go, and it's kind of remarkable.
It is, and you want to make sure people are safe on their stairs, and when you first say, okay, we're going to do some stairs before you leave, they kind of look at you like you might be crazy before you leave, but you know, practicing on stairs and make sure they're safe to get in and out of their home and walk and do their exercises and all that starts the day of surgery or the day after.
They should have clapped. They should have applauded for me. I still think they missed a bet. John from Leawood. John, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question on stem cell therapy and what the how effective that is and what your opinion is, and I'll take my answer off the air. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, John. Doctor, talk to us about stem cell therapy.
Sure. So that's sort of the treatment that's catching on. It's had a lot of press. The data is sort of highly variable.
And what would you use stem cell for? I mean, is it instead of doing a replacement, or is it, what are we talking about here?
Right. So there's a lot of people that they have arthritis, and they've either been offered a joint replacement or sort of, you know, threatened that at some point in the future they might need a joint replacement. So they're looking for something other than surgery, which is sort of the natural human response. And we have some decent non-surgical treatments, but in the end, based on the severity of the disease or the severity of the arthritis, that's the sort of end of the road. So when people are looking at that, they're trying to avoid surgery. They're going to naturally sort of seek other options, and stem cell injections is something that is commonly performed. It's a cash basis. It's not covered by insurance companies, and I think it's something that's considered sort of pre-experimental. Conceptually, as an orthopedic surgeon and previously as a scientist, we love the concept of stem cells. We just adore them. We think this is going to be the greatest thing. I think we're a long way from understanding how to get the correct stem cells and to put them in a place and teach them what they need to do if they're going to repair a joint. I think we're very, very far away from that.
Yeah, I'm told, I've read that when people try to stave off surgery by trying these intermediate steps, that by and large, that can be a big waste of money. Am I right, or is that too much?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, that'd be your advice as a doctor.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to some calls here. And Rosalie from Warrensburg. Rosalie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. My question is there an upper age limit at which knee replacement or hip replacement is no longer recommended? And I'm sure that varies depending upon the health of the individual.
How high can you go on the age meter here, doctor?
Yes. So, I think personally, I have not taken a patient in their 90s for an elective joint replacement. In fracture circumstances, we do joint replacements in older patients. But electively, I have not gone into the 90s, but I certainly know joint surgeons who have.
How high have you gone?
High 80s.
And Hannah,
almost to 90.
How do those folks manage their recoveries? Because I was in my 50s for my first one. I had turned 60 for my second one. And I was glad to be a little bit younger because I was able to manage it. I remember thinking that when I was going through it.
Yeah, I think, honestly, several 80-year-olds, upper 80-year-olds that get knee replacements or hip replacements, and they do really well. You know, kind
Is
of
that
the,
right?
Yeah,
really?
Typically they do. Granted, there's a wide range of how people tolerate the replacements. But usually what they're trying to get back to doing is not the running and the tennis and the activities that some of the younger people want to get back to doing.
They just want to get around the house or the yard.
And get rid of their pain. And sometimes going up and down the stairs, getting up and out of chairs, their pain's gone and they do well with their replacements.
Yeah, doctor.
Yes. So one thing just to recall is that patients over the age of 70 tend to be the most satisfied with their joints. And we think it's principally two things. One is their experience of pain. So younger patients tend to have more experience of pain. And we think that's related to the structure and integrity of the tissues. But the second is the expected demands. And so the functional demands for someone who's 75 are going to be different than someone who's under 55.
I see. Rosalie, I hope that helped.
Very helpful. Thank you so much.
You know, I remember sitting here doing the show before I got my first one, and it was all I could do to sit still and try to have a conversation when I was wiggling and waggling and trying to get comfortable, which, of course, at the end, you could never get comfortable. It was that kind of... So my point is, you sort of know when the time has come. There's not much doubt in your mind, right?
Yes. Some people come in and they're not sure, and they'll want, you know... Many times, mostly in my practice, what I say is when you're ready, when you can't live the life you want with the knee or the shoulder that you have, then get a new one. And so it's really the patient's experience of their suffering and disability versus their perceived risks.
And you're waking up at night and all that stuff, and I don't miss those days. Liz from Prairie Village. Liz, you want a new hip or a new knee, or what do you want? We're selling them here today just outside our studios, yeah.
I'm in my upper 70s. I could probably use a lot of new parts. Do you have any software? I'm calling about a knee. I've had a right knee. Well, I have arthritis in both knees, but the right knee is crooked. And if you know today's ladies' pants, they're very tight, and that crooked knee... And what I'm saying is I'm more vain than in pain. I can't wear these new snug pants with this crooked knee accented. I don't have a whole lot of pain at all except on stairs, and I can manage the stairs okay.
I'm betting it's not as bad as you think, Liz. At least that's my hope.
I don't know whether I've gotten used to it or what. Yeah.
Doctor?
Well, the vanity section, yeah, that's a software issue. But in terms of having what you call a crooked leg, in some cases the crooked leg sets you up for worsening progressive degeneration. In some cases, it really doesn't make much of a difference. So if you're bow-legged, your surgeon will say you could be bow-legged for as long as you want. It rarely changes how the surgery is done or influences our decision. But if you're knock-kneed, that's a little bit different problem that should have a real evaluation.
Okay. We're going to have to leave our conversation there, Liz. Good luck to you. And I want to thank our guests from the Kansas City Orthopedic Institute, Dr. Christopher Peer. Hannah Rousen is a physical therapist there. Thank you both for a good conversation. We sure appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Yesterday on the show, we sat down with Harvest Public Media reporters to discuss drought, tariffs, and the farm bill. You can hear that conversation and other previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at the history and future of the Truce Corridor and how one upcoming festival looks to unite the community. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.